From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a judge who has sent men to be executed reflects on the death penalty. We talk with Alex Kaczynski, a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. He's had to decide on the fate of death row inmates petitioning for stays on the eve of execution. Kaczynski's article, Tinkering with Death, was recently published in The New Yorker. Also, crewing on the first woman's team to compete for the America's Cup. We talk with Anna Seton Huntington about what it was like to compete in a sport associated with the elite male-dominated world of yacht clubs. Her new memoir is called Making Waves. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Supreme Court has ruled that a key environmental law lets people sue even if they seek less, not more, protection for endangered species. The decision was unanimous. It says people who claim to have suffered economic harm may use the Endangered Species Act to file lawsuits and accuse the federal government of doing too much to protect some species. The ruling in the Oregon case is a defeat for the Clinton administration. The decision probably will affect environmental disputes across the country. Authorities say there is no more threat of poison chemicals leaking from a capsized barge into the Mississippi River at Baton Rouge. Amy Whittington of Louisiana Radio Network reports.
Louisiana State Police are keeping close watch but have issued the all-clear now that air quality monitors show a zero reading for benzene and toluene from the seeping tank barge. Divers in the flood-swollen river searched the vessel throughout the night and have found the source of the leak. The barge was loaded with 400,000 gallons of the chemicals when it broke away from a string of barges on Monday. The near 2,600 Southern University students evacuated when a blue cloud of chemical vapors blanketed the area have been transported back to campus this morning after spending the night at LSU. 35 people are reported to have visited local hospitals for exposure to toxic fumes. For National Public Radio, I'm Amy Whittington in Baton Rouge.
Zaire and Parliament voted yesterday to remove the country's prime minister. Government supporters contested the vote, saying there weren't enough lawmakers present. NPR's Michael Scola reports from Kinshasa.
The vote came just hours after Prime Minister Kengo Wadondo left the country to attend talks with other African leaders on Zaire's civil war. One government official called it a parliamentary coup. In an unscheduled debate, a majority of parliamentarians voted to oust the prime minister, including many once considered his allies. But the vote did not achieve the three-fourths majority required by the Constitution. Still, supporters of the prime minister say it may be very difficult for him to stay in office and represent the nation after this show of no confidence. Prime Minister Kengo is unpopular, and many blame him for bungling the war and failing to negotiate with the rebels. The power vacuum in Zaire seems complete, with the president ill in Europe, the army badly defeated by rebels, and the government in limbo. Anything can happen now, warned a Western diplomat. This is Michael Scholar in Kinshasa.
The Israeli Supreme Court has refused to block construction of a Jewish settlement in Arab East Jerusalem. Justices say they want to wait until they hear claims that the building project discriminates against Palestinians. The court has given the Israeli government 60 days to explain its plans. Separate appeals to temporarily block the construction have been filed today by Arab landowners and Israeli peace activists. On Wall Street, the Dow was down nearly 38 points at 6,858. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the major stock indices have stayed within a narrow range of trading this morning. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The stock market is being buffeted by the prospect of higher interest rates. Today's inflation news was slightly stronger than expected, though still moderate. The consumer price index gained 0.3% last month. Strength in drug shares is being offset by weakness among high technology issues. The chief investment strategist at Morgan Stanley, Barton Biggs, says that a bear market has crept up on the high-tech group. That news has the tech-laden NASDAQ Composite down for the seventh straight day. Trading in Sprint was delayed this morning following a report in the Wall Street Journal that the company is the takeover target of Britain's Cable and Wireless. Sprint is calling that story dead wrong. I'm Doug Krisner.
Texaco and Shell Oil, the U.S. arm of Dutch giant Royal Shell, rather Royal Dutch Shell, say they will merge much of the U.S. petroleum refining and marketing sectors. The combination creates a smaller firm with 8 refineries and 600 miles of pipeline. The venture is intended to cut costs. Bell Atlantic and NYMEX could face more delays in closing their $23 billion merger. Officials from both companies will be at an important meeting today with Justice Department antitrust officials. The agency's been reviewing the deal for the past year, and the companies worry the agency won't approve the merger. The Justice Department is asking rivals of Bell Atlantic and NYMEX about plans to expand phone service in New York State. Some analysts say they suspect the deal will be approved, but with some conditions, such as spinning off the jointly owned wireless business and having NYMEX and Bell Atlantic start that from scratch. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve health and health care for all Americans.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alex Kaczynski is a judge who supports the death penalty and has sent about a dozen men to death, denying their last-minute petitions for stays of execution. He reflected on how it feels to send another man to die in an article called Tinkering with Death, published in the February 10th issue of The New Yorker. Kaczynski is a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. The first time he was directly involved in an execution was in 1990. He was called to rule on a stay requested by the parents of Thomas Ball, who was convicted of killing a woman bus driver during a robbery. Ball had waived his right to appeal, but his parents said he was not mentally competent to waive the right. 3 appeals judges heard the case. 2 ruled in favor of the stay. Judge Kaczynski dissented. But the Supreme Court lifted the stay, citing Kaczynski's opinion. I asked the judge what he was thinking the night before Ball was executed. Did the judge feel he had done the right thing, or was the judge disturbed by the thought of Ball dying by lethal injection?
Well, you know, both were true. I had thought about the case carefully. I do think about my cases carefully, and I take very seriously all my cases, and particularly cases involving people's life and liberty. So I was quite confident that my decision or my view of the matter was correct, and it wasn't just because the Supreme Court agreed with me. I felt confident in my own right. So I thought that what was going on was the thing that was the right thing. At the same time, I found it intensely disturbing, intensely troubling. I knew that in a very concrete way, I had taken part in a process, and maybe played a key part in a process that would result in the death of this this boy. He was in his 20s. I guess he's a man, but a very young man would be put to death by the state. Now, and I found that disturbing. I must say, though, the things we deal with in the law often are disturbing. Putting people in prison for long periods of time is disturbing. Seeing the crimes that are committed, seeing evidence of the crimes that are committed is disturbing. It's a difficult area. It's kind of like being in an emergency room. You see some of the worst things in society.
I know you didn't attend the execution. When the time of his execution arrived, were you watching the clock and thinking?
Well, I was trying to sleep, actually, but not always doing a good job of it. As I said, the execution was set for 7 o'clock, and I went to bed, I guess, about midnight or so. A number of times throughout the night, I kept waking up, and the thought would pop in my mind, and I kind of sit upright and think, my God, is he dead already? And then I noticed it was still dark outside, and this was June. I knew that the execution was set at 7 o'clock, would be past sunrise, so I'd have to kind of calm myself and go back to sleep. I should make it clear again. It is It is disturbing. It is troubling. It is not the kind of thing that we are accustomed to doing. And I think probably the death penalty should not be something that we ever get used to and take lightly.
Well, yeah, that's why I'm wondering if that queasiness that you felt that first time, if that went away with subsequent cases or if that stayed with you. And either way, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's fair to say that the first time was the worst, but I've never gotten used to it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when Robert Alton Harris was executed. It was a horrible night. I don't know if you recall, he was the guy out here who killed the two boys while they were sitting eating their McDonald's hamburgers and then finished their lunch and kind of laughed at having done so. And the boys' families were very intent on having Harris executed, and he eventually was. What happened in Harris's case is there were several stages of execution issued by my court, including one that was issued after Harris was actually sitting in the gas chamber waiting to, strapped to the chair waiting for the pellet of cyanide to drop in the sulfuric acid. And he was taken out of the gas chamber, and he essentially got a two-hour reprieve. The Supreme Court eventually lifted the final stay and entered an order saying no more stays from any federal judges. Then he was put to death. I found that intensely disturbing. I mean, I hadn't had much sympathy for Harris before that, but my God, to be marched into the death chamber and be taken out and then be marched in again just struck me as being sort of cruel.
What is it that you found most disturbing there, the fact that he was executed or the fact that he was reprieved, the execution was delayed, but it finally happened, the reprieve was just like a delay?
Well, I found both things disturbing. I think executions are disturbing things, and they ought to be. We ought not to take life lightly. At the same time, I think we make the process unnecessarily difficult and painful by having incredibly long delays before the execution is carried out, sometimes 5, 10, 20 years.
Now, don't the people who are asking for the stay of execution, don't they finally just want to see the person saved from execution? Isn't that the point?
Well, certainly that's the case. If you, execution delayed is maybe an execution deferred completely, so they always are seeking for a stay. But that's not the entire problem. A big problem is that we don't have enough trained lawyers to handle these very difficult cases and actually take them through to completion. So there are lots of cases sitting there, lots of prisoners sitting on death row who haven't got a lawyer to go forward with their appeal.
When you're ruling on an appeal, on an execution, Do you ever meet the person who you're ruling on?
Never. We never meet. On appeal, we never meet the criminal defendants. In fact, we never meet parties at all on appeal.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if that makes it easier to rule on behalf of execution, because you're not looking the person in the eye. You're not watching them, you know, as a human being in the flesh across the room.
Well, it may be, although, of course, we don't impose sentence. We review for legal error.
Mm-hmm.
We look at whether the process was fair. And questions like whether or not the individual deserves leniency are resolved by the trial court, by the jury, by the trial judge. And they do get to see the defendant. On the other hand, you know, or at the same time, I have seen my share of defendants since I do trials on occasion. And I must say, they're not all very sympathetic looking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure they sometimes do themselves any good by their presence.
You write in your New Yorker article that you've never attended an execution. Why not? Do you think, you know, some people would argue anybody who's sentencing somebody to death ought to witness what an execution is like?
Well, I've never been invited, to tell you the truth, is one reason I haven't done it. And it would be difficult to do since I'm actually ruling on the case as the case is proceeding to execution. I have to be in my office or wherever I can rule on the case. It's hard to get directly involved by being present. That having been said, I think it would be a gruesome thing to watch. I certainly am not anxious to do so.
How many times have you ruled that a person should be executed?
I don't have a number on the top of my head. I've had a dozen or two death cases, and in most of them, overwhelming number of them, I have ruled in favor of upholding the sentence.
Tell us more about what you have to look for when you're making your decision.
Well, as I said, we review for legal error, and not just for legal error. We review to determine whether or not the trial and the appeal process in the state court conformed with constitutional standards. And there's a whole variety of questions that we have to look at, but most fundamental of them are, did the guy have an adequate lawyer? Did he have competent counsel? Were the instructions given to the jury about the death penalty, were they constitutionally consistent with Supreme Court rulings? And there's a whole body of case law written by the Supreme Court that explains what a state must do in order to put somebody to death. It's not enough, for example, that somebody have committed a killing. There are lots of killings, from vehicular manslaughter to first-degree torture murder. There's a wide range. Even people who commit first-degree murder are not, which is the intentional killing of a human being with malice aforethought, are not automatically eligible for the death penalty. The Supreme Court has said that there has to be something more, aggravating circumstances, like killing for money or killing for torture or killing for sexual gratification. There's a long list of aggravating factors. So what we look at is to determine whether or not the trial was conducted fairly, whether it was conducted in accordance with constitutional standards. And that's often a very complex question.
Have you always supported the death penalty? And tell us why you do support it.
Well, I don't mean to come off as being the ultimate defender of the death penalty. I've had doubts in the past. I had doubts before I started dealing on death cases. There are arguments about finality, about, you know, if you make a mistake, you can't take it back, about whether or not the state should have the authority to take human life. And I had some of those doubts myself until I started working on death cases. And I must tell you, it is an experience that shakes your confidence in your fellow human beings. These are not cases where somebody commits crimes of passion, walks in and you know, finds a spouse in bed with somebody else and shoots them both. I mean, that's horrible enough, but these are not the kind of cases we're talking about. We're talking about cases where people escape from prison and then spend days traveling across farmland and finding isolated families and then methodically raping, torturing, and killing them, entire families, one at a time, without mercy, without compassion, for no legitimate reason at all, not for robbery or anything else, just for the fun of it. And you read enough cases like this. You read enough cases involving people who torture and kill for their personal pleasure and who commit sexual acts on children and then stuff their bodies in trash cans. It makes you... at least gave me the feeling that maybe people like those are no longer deserving to be part of the human race. What they do is so despicable, shows so much disregard for other people's autonomy, for other people's personhood, that maybe they forfeit their own right to live among us.
My guest is Judge Alex Kaczynski. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Judge Alex Kaczynski, an appeals judge who supports the death penalty and has upheld the death sentence in about a dozen cases. I don't know if this is too personal or not, but I know for some people they have one set of instincts from their legal work and another set of instincts from their religious convictions. And I wonder if you are a religious man at all and what your religious principles tell you about execution?
I'm not deeply religious. I'm Jewish. After I wrote my New Yorker article, I got a note from my rabbi.
What did he say?
The rabbi at my synagogue, my congregation is a she, this was a different rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, who I often appear on programs for, so I refer to him as my rabbi as well. And what he wrote back is he gave me passages from the Talmud that make it quite clear that execution is an appropriate form of punishment under Jewish law. So I was gratified to see that. But the truth is, it's one of those things that one has to make up one's own mind on. It's a very difficult question. I can certainly understand people coming to the opposite conclusion, and I can most certainly understand people coming to the opposite conclusion if they don't look at the nitty-gritty of the facts. They don't look at how these cases come down,
mm-hmm.
at what actually happens in the kind of the horrible, horrible facts that the kind of inhumanity that is perpetrated.
Do you dread these cases? Do you dread having to deal with the appeal of an execution?
It's not something I look forward to, I must tell you. They are incredibly absorbing, and they come up at the most peculiar times. It's easily an area of my jurisdiction that I could give up. In fact, about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I wrote a piece in the New York Times dealing with another aspect of the death penalty. And what I suggested is that we're never going to be able to execute all the people on death row. And my prescription was to limit it to the very worst people, the very most heinous criminals, and do a good job of giving them fair trials and then, if appropriate, execute them and be done with. They're essentially reprieve everybody else.
When you say we won't be able to put to death everybody on death row, do you mean because we don't have the resolve to do it, or we don't have the court time and the number of lawyers to go through with the whole process?
We don't have the resolve, and we don't have the resources. In order to execute everybody on death row that we have on death row now, we'd have to essentially do an execution a day for the next 10 years. I just don't think we have a stomach for that. But we don't have the resources. Each case involves incredible amounts of lawyers' time and court time. They divert resources away from the other things courts have to do.
Now, do you think a lot about what is the most humane approach to execution?
Well, I do give some thought. I have given some thought to the method of execution. There's a remarkable amount of actual case law dealing with how somebody gets executed. All the kind of traditional methods of thought were humane, like hanging and electrocution and the gas chamber, all turn out to have difficulties attached to them. Electric chairs sometimes malfunction. They put the juice through and the guy lives and kind of sit there and is still talking. Gas chamber, there's evidence that it's quite painful for several minutes. Hanging is an interesting one because if you don't do it quite right, when the trap door opens, the body doesn't drop far enough, instead of breaking the neck, the person winds up strangulating. But if the body drops too far, it can actually pull the guy's head off. So it's actually a fairly delicate balance. It turns out killing somebody without leaving a mark and doing it in a way that's painless and quick turns out to be a very difficult, fairly difficult thing to do. The emerging technology, the one that seems to be accepted most frequently now, is lethal injection, where they put the drug cocktail in the vein and put the guy to death. I think at the end of Dead Man Walking, there's a scene where we're shown an execution by lethal injection. My problem with that is it's a little too close for my taste to what they do to people in hospitals, to the art of healing. And I think it also just masks the violence that we commit when we carry out an execution. It's the most violent thing that a society can do to one of its members.
And you think we should face that when we do it?
Yeah, I don't think it should look like going to the doctor's office. No, yeah, I think we ought to come to grips with the fact that we're doing an incredibly violent thing.
Judge Alex Kaczynski sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion with Judge Alex Kaczynski about deciding on death penalty cases. Also, making waves in the male-dominated sport of sailing, we talk with Anna Seton Huntington about her experiences on the first women's team to compete for the America's Cup. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Judge Alex Kaczynski. He supports the death penalty and has sent about a dozen men to be executed. He sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. His article, Tinkering with Death, A Death Penalty Judge Reflects, was published in the February 10th issue of The New Yorker. You have said that one of the reasons why you support execution in certain cases is for the sake of the families of the victims. The survivors, you know, who want some kind of retribution and some sense of finality. What do you think execution does for the loved ones of the victim?
You know, that's a very good question. And unfortunately, it's a question that we have had no methodical study on. And it really surprises me that nobody has bothered to look at that aspect of the question, because it seems to me that is the most relevant thing. We know for a fact that many victims' families, not maybe all, I mean, I keep thinking of JFK, the Kennedy family after RFK, Bobby Kennedy got killed, and the family came out and said, you know, we don't want execution for Sirhan. So I know there are families out there who don't want execution, but by and large, a lot of the families do vehemently ask for the execution of the perpetrator. They tell us that having the person executed gives them a sense of relief, gives them a sense of release, gives them a sense of closure on this really traumatic aspect of their existence. And, you know, in my book, if that is true, if that is right, it seems to me that's a very good reason for us to go through with executions. If we manage to give even a small measure of relief and closure to the victims' families, then I think we would be remiss in our responsibility if we didn't take the necessary steps to give them that relief.
When you're ruling on an execution, do you try to just examine the facts as dispassionately as possible so that you can consider whether or not this appeal is justified? Or do you try to become kind of involved in the drama of the case and try to understand the personality?
You know, it's very hard not to get involved in the drama of the case. The more than in just about any other kind of case, the facts pull you along. You got compelling, brutal facts that, and it's very hard. You kind of have to steel yourself not to be swept away with the facts. But as I said, our job is to deal with questions of law.
Right.
And as best I can, I try to distance myself from the brutal facts.
This is a hypothetical question, but say you had a change of heart and you started to oppose the death penalty on moral principles. As a judge, would you feel it was your responsibility to carry it out anyways, or do you think that you'd refuse to sentence somebody to death because you morally disagreed with it in principle?
You know, it's a hard question to answer because I'm not in that situation.
Right, and you don't know really how you'd feel if you were.
I do know there are lots of laws that I don't agree with that I apply, not always cheerfully, but I apply. But I also know that on a question like this, it really cuts to the core of who you are. And if a judge... or if I were really morally opposed to it, if I really thought it was really the wrong thing for a society to do, then I don't know that I could decide the cases. And the question then would become, what do I do about it? I think the right thing to do at that point is to simply refuse to participate in such cases. If you can't get yourself to, for whatever reason, if you can't get yourself to apply the law as it is written, if the law is constitutional, but for moral reasons you can't apply it, then it seems to me you have such a bias in the case that you can't be fair-minded.
Do you think at some point you will actually attend an execution?
Probably not.
Why not?
Probably not. There are logistical difficulties, for one thing. The execution in California carried out in St. Quentin, and of course they often get delayed by by stays. And in any event, I can't really attend an execution in my circuit because I'm involved in the process. I could be involved in the last-minute appeal. So it becomes kind of difficult. But I just think it'd be a gruesome thing to watch. I tell the story in the New Yorker article about a friend of mine who represented a death row inmate and actually saw him get executed. And I talked to my friend right afterwards, and it was actually a couple of days afterwards, and he looked like ash. He was completely blown away. He says the process is really gruesome. I don't look forward to ever observing anything like that. Maybe I should. I wonder whether if I'm going to be handling these cases, that maybe I should go see an execution, see it carried out. And if I can't watch it, maybe I shouldn't do it. I've never been put to the test. I've never been invited. So I can say I've never turned down the opportunity to watch an execution.
Judge Alex Kaczynski, he sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. His article, Tinkering with Death, was recently published in The New Yorker. Coming up, a member of the first women's team to compete for the America's Cup. This is Fresh Air. Many of the stereotypes about women's strength, stamina, and competitive drive are challenged by women athletes who are making inroads into male-dominated sports. In 1995, Anna Seton Huntington was a member of the first women's team to compete for the America's Cup, the world's premier sailing race. She says America's Cup racing has been cloistered inside the elite, clubby, wholly male-dominated world of yacht clubs. And in most of those clubs, women's official roles are often limited to fashion shows and girls' nights out. Huntington has written a new memoir about her experiences on the women's team called Making Waves. I asked her how the women's team was started.
The women's team was a brainstorm of Bill Cokes. He was the person who won the America's Cup in 1992, a very wealthy man who'd taken up sailing late in life, and he's kind of got a knack for coming into things and shaking them up, and he wanted to field a women's team because he felt like it was time for women to have a chance in the sport, and I think he also felt like he'd like to see the old guard squirm a little bit. And so he started planning and putting together a crew in the fall of 1993, actually.
How did you end up on the women's team?
I ended up on the women's team because I had been an Olympic rower, and I'd gotten a bronze medal in 1992. And there's a long tradition of among the men of rowers being brought on board to be grinders, which is a position that requires a lot of strength and endurance, which rowers have, but doesn't necessarily require a lot of sailing knowledge. It's something that you can sort of pick up along the way.
So what does a grinder do?
The grinder, if anyone's seen the America's Cup on television, it's the person who's sort of hunched over a waist-high pedestal, turning what appears to be bicycle pedals with her hands. And the handles are mechanically attached to the winches on the boats, and the winches draw in the lines that raise the sails and also move them from side to side, which is something that's constantly happening during the course of a four-hour race.
In your book, Making Waves, you write that when you joined the women's team, you had a vision of fighting a battle on behalf of all women, and that you imagined a team propelled by a collective vision of creating opportunities and changing perceptions. But that's not what you found. What did you find?
I guess I found a group of women who were much more interested in sort of immersing themselves in a sailing experience and perhaps in furthering themselves or their careers as sailors. They were not necessarily interested in how our efforts might pay off for the future, although that was, you know, sort of a bonus, I think, but from many people's perspective, but it certainly wasn't, most people's purpose for being there. The general sense was that, you know, we're athletes, not feminists.
You say that the women on the team favored teamwork over hierarchy. In fact, they even eliminated the skipper position.
Yeah, well, actually, those were ethics that were given to us by the coaches. The coaches thought that they would eliminate the skipper's position, which is a position that's, you know, kind of generated through centuries of maritime tradition. It's a position on the boat that it's pretty necessary. I mean, you have an intense competitive environment. You have chaos in terms of noise and lines and sails and 16 people doing all different things, and you really need that one voice of authority to be able to rise above it all and catch everyone's attention. But the assumption that our coaches made was that, well, they're women and they will get along better by consensus or operating by committee than they will operating by hierarchy. So they decided to remove the skipper's position and just sort of give us this nebulous system for operating as a group.
So how did that work out?
It was actually fairly disastrous for us because it impeded the development of leadership among us. What ended up happening was that there were two women in the back of the boat, Leslie Egnott and J.J. Eisler, who carried most of the burden for making decisions. And because neither one of them had been designated the skipper and neither one of them, neither one of them felt comfortable saying, you know, I should be the skipper, even though the coaches have said we shouldn't have a skipper. Those two were just locked in a battle for control. And so often, you know, they were on the boat in racing situations needing to make split-second decisions and being forced to sort of have discussions about what they thought was right instead of one person being able to snap her fingers and say, you know, we're going left here. So what ended up happening is that, I guess, simply put, we just ended up developing a leadership gap in the back of the boat. And a little more than halfway through the racing, the coaches, who were frustrated with the lack of leadership, despite the fact that I think they were largely responsible for it, they decided to remove J.J. Eisler, who was the tactician, and replace her with David Dellenbaugh, who had been the tactician on the 1992 team. And so that was, you know, in essence, that was the end of the women's team.
It's a difficult spot to be in when you're new to a sport or to a field because, you know, you want to be independent and everything. On the other hand, you don't have a lot of experience because you haven't been allowed in there before. So it's a problem. You want to be able to do it all. On the other hand, you're not nearly as experienced as the people who have years and generations, you know, of insiderness.
That's true. We were absolutely dependent on the men who were coaching and managing us, even though our professed goal was to win as a group of women and to sort of make a statement about women's abilities. We had, just by the nature of things, I guess in some ways it was a catch-22. We were absolutely dependent on the men to teach us the basics of sailing and to a certain extent lead us through our first experience out there racing against other men who had decades of America's Cup experience under their belt. Although I guess I felt like there was room at a certain point for our coaches and managers to hand us the reins or for us to take them out of their hands one way or the other. And I think that if that was something that had been planned early on, it might actually have happened.
Your boat didn't have a skipper because the male management thought that you'd be better off with teamwork than hierarchy. Do you think that women on the boat would have been uncomfortable giving orders or taking orders?
I think that we had, among us, we had women, you know, for example, J.J. Eisler, who had years of skippering experience. In fact, she'd been in match races skippering boats of men, and she was used to giving orders. It was something that came pretty naturally to her. We also had Don Riley, who had raced around the world twice and skippered. In one of those cases, she had skippered the boat in the Whitbread race. So I don't think that it was any inherent lack of comfort with being in charge of things. What I think happened was largely that there was this sort of edict from above, from our coaches, that teamwork was what was going to get us across the finish line first. And so there was a real effort at all times to display our ability to work together. And in fact, a handful of very qualified women had been cut right off the bat when they were putting the team roster together. And I think they were cut in large part because their personalities didn't really appear to fit in. They appeared to be too bossy and too controlling. And so when women who had, you know, Olympic gold medals or had been Rolex yachtswomen of the year, when women with those kind of credentials got cut, I think it was a real red flag to people to focus on teamwork and to sort of, demonstrate their ability to get along, not necessarily to assert their ego.
One of your male opponents referred to your boat as the lesbo boat. What was the reaction of the women on the team to that?
Yeah, Dennis Connor, who is sort of Mr. America's Cup himself, he's been in 7 America's Cup races and won 4 of them, and we had a pretty lively relationship with Dennis. He was not altogether welcoming of our team, and he at a cocktail party, actually, he referred to one of the women on our team. He didn't want his wife talking to her, and he said, you know, don't talk to her because she's on the lesbo boat. And at that point, Annie Nelson, the woman on our team, you know, looked up and somebody said, oh, Annie, don't take that from him. And she said, okay, I won't. And she dumped her rum and coke on his head. And I guess in some ways, although all of that Dennis denies, but in some ways I think it had a real galvanizing effect on our team. It was a real kind of in-your-face move on Annie's part. And I think it just gave us a sense that Dennis was scared of us in a way.
It sounds from your book that after that comment, there was an attempt to prove we are heterosexual. People were like enumerating the number of married people on board, the number of, number of women with children. And
Well, that's something that that's a desire to prove our heterosexuality was something that was there sort of right from the start with. You know, the marketing of our team. I think there was a great deal of concern about us coming across as anything but wives or potential wives or mothers or whatever. That they, you know, no one on our team and no one marketing our team, or very few, wanted to risk being associated with anything with lesbianism, or didn't want to risk the perception that there might be a lesbian aboard our boat. And I guess my sense was that was all so beside the point, and that, you know, so what if there were lesbians on our team? It didn't affect our ability to prove women have a right to be competing in the America's Cup. I just didn't see what the connection was. And I felt in some ways like it was such a holdover from the past. You know, it was such a dug up insult. People have been dismissing female athletes for decades, saying that they're lesbians. So I found it particularly uncreative and also just sort of irrelevant.
My guest is Anna Seton Huntington. In 1995, she was a member of the first women's team to compete for the America's Cup, the world's premier sailing race. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anna Huntington, her new book, Making Waves, is about her experiences on the first women's team to compete for the America's Cup. How did you do in the final race?
The very last race was against Dennis Connor, and it was a race where if he won, he would then go on to the America's Cup against Team New Zealand, and if we won, we would have one last race against the other U.S. team packed. And that race would then decide which of us would go on to the final America's Cup. And so it was a do or die race. And the race is 18 miles long. It's six legs and six 3 mile legs. And we actually led for the first five legs and developed an enormous margin over Dennis, in large part because the wind was so light and just sort of dying the whole day. And so the boats just spread further and further apart. And in fact, when we came around the last buoy and headed for home, ESPN, who was covering the race, cut away because they were so convinced that there was no chance for us to get beaten, that there was no chance for Dennis to make a comeback. And they cut away to spring training or something. And we came around the buoy and went over to one side of the course, and Dennis came around the buoy and went over to the other side. And as can happen in sailboat racing, the wind just sort of, you know, unfortunately or magically, you know, from his perspective probably, followed him down the course and left us in a big hole. And he managed to get a lead over our boat and ultimately eventually win the race.
So did you feel like very defeated knowing that you were close to winning and then lost? Did it make losing even harder?
I guess actually I'd say no, it didn't. I think that we knew that we were so close and we knew that we'd almost taken it from the master of the game. And I think it gave all of us a sense more than, you know, initially, yeah, there was a sense of tragedy, but I think probably in the long run, it gave all of us more of a sense that we almost had it. We really almost did do it. And so I think having been so close, yeah, it might have made it hurt more, but it gave us a sense of our own abilities, I think, also.
Are you still sailing or rowing?
My husband and I have a sailboat, and we sail on that. And I have We also have a 7-month-old son, so it's recreational activities seem to be sort of limited at the moment. But I do look forward to a day when I take him out in the sailboat.
So you got pregnant shortly after the race?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So you went from one physical thing to a very different physical experience.
Yeah, it's true. That was absolutely a mind-boggling experience, kind of letting go of control of my body.
Right, and yes, exactly. Every muscle must be tight.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So did you work out while you were pregnant?
I started out with these plans of, you know, emerging from pregnancy in better shape than I had gone in and all of this stuff. And, you know, I'd say probably my 3rd month I made it to the Y to swim maybe once or twice and put on the standard 40 pounds. And, you know, you're in the back seat when you're pregnant. Mother Nature just takes over. And it was a real different experience for me as an athlete, just feeling like I had to let go and go along for the ride.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, thank you very much.
Anna Seton Huntington is the author of Making Waves. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Alan Tu, Joan Tui Westman, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth and Tracy Tannenbaum. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.